This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. District Council 37 is the city's largest union of city workers, representing 125,000 members and 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sunday evenings at 8 p.m., and we rebroadcast Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. You can also listen to State of the Union on iTunes. Go to the podcast app on your iPhone and iPad and search for DC 37 State of the Union to hear our latest shows and to subscribe for free. It is our pleasure and privilege to be joined tonight by New York City public advocate Letitia James. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Chris, and hello to all of your listeners and to members of DC 37.
All right. We wanted to talk about the groundbreaking gender pay equity bill.
So it's a bill that was signed by the mayor of the city of New York, a bill that I proposed that would address pay inequity in the city of New York. Basically, it would ban salary history. So when a prospective employer ask a prospective employee about their previous salary history, that would no longer be allowed in the city of New York because women have been discriminated against, and we want to stop the perpetuation of discrimination based on wage. Women on average are paid less than men. Women on average leave the workforce for a variety of reasons. And so when you return to the workforce, if employers ask you your previous salary history, it tends to be dated. And it also tends to be based on a discriminatory system because women are just paid less than men. And so as opposed to asking prospective employees about their previous salary history, we are urging that employers post salaries as opposed to asking about the worth of the value of one's worth.
This is like sounds to me like one of the cleanest, simplest, smartest ways to balance the bill. You know what I mean? It's like if women are making less and they are asked, what is your salary? And you have to keep on telling people your salary that is less than a man's salary, then they're going to keep paying you less, right?
Correct. You perpetuate discrimination. You perpetuate pay inequality, the disparity, and it continues all the way until you retire. And so that discrimination is reflected in your pension.
Now, this goes back to a report, if I remember correctly, that women in New York City earn less than a certain amount. It was a big amount, less in wages each year than men.
Well, women on average make 77 cents on every dollar for a male, but for Black and Latino women, it's even less. It's around 56 cents. And so what we are trying to do is address wage inequality, wage disparity, and address, for the most part, on a larger scale, and that is the feminization of poverty that I am seeing and that we are seeing throughout the city of New York. And so this is just one way. Is this going to solve all of our problems? No, by no means. But this is just one step in the direction of addressing wage inequality in the city of New York, and we are looking at some other ways and means by which we can address the disparity that continues to exist.
Now, you were also out on May 1st, which is typically a International Workers' Day, but you are this year. It seems to me that you know we live in such difficult times now.
We're in uncertain times. We're in the midst of a storm,
and there's a lot that needs to be talked about.
And, you know, May Day, May 1st, we celebrated the value of workers, the importance of workers. But more importantly, we focused on the importance of immigrants and refugees and women in general and workers in general and the labor force in general and the importance of collective bargaining and the importance of the labor movement. And the reason why in the city of New York there's not a race to the bottom is primarily because this is a union town. And we need to celebrate that, and we need to keep that strong and maintain that. And any efforts to turn New York into a right-to-work state state, which is really a right to absolutely nothing. It's more than a race to the bottom. Is not going to happen. We're going to continue to protect the union movement. We're going to continue to protect the right to organize, collective bargaining, and all of the benefits that members of DC 37 enjoy, including but not limited to having the weekend off.
Which was a right that was brought to us by unions.
That's right. That's right. Let's not forget that.
And I think too often we have a difficult time, we in the labor movement have a difficult time explaining to non-union folks that the rights that unions have fought and won apply to their lives as well. That, you know, it's not just about, it is about, you know, union density creates worker strength across the board.
Right.
And that in places where there are strong unions, all workers are doing better.
Exactly. The reason why we have a middle class is because of the union movement. And the reason why, you know, we've got civil rights and women's rights and so many progressive campaigns in this country is because of the support of the labor movement. Right now, what we are seeing in New York City, we are seeing in the construction trades, we're seeing so on non-union jobs and on non-union sites, we're seeing individuals, primarily immigrants, who are dying because of unsafe conditions. And that, you know, that may happen on a union site, but based on studies, invariably, most of the fatalities occur on non-union sites. And in fact, the vast majority in this city have been on non-union sites. And so, and what happens is, the construction managers, the developers, the whatever, they walk away from these individuals, these immigrants, and they lawyer up and they refuse to talk to anyone. And these immigrants oftentimes are left fending, you know, their families are left fending for themselves without any benefits for the worker who died. We see it over time and time again. We are also seeing the fight against Spectrum right now in Charter. Local 3, they're on strike. Bloomingdale's just voted for a contract, thank God. We are seeing car washeros on strike. We are seeing the fast food workers continue to rise up demanding fair wages. So there are so many fights and so many fronts. And even in DC 37, there has been campaigns to raise the wages of women. In fact, there's been litigation that's been filed against this administration by some of your sister unions alleging pay disparity.
We're talking with public advocate Letitia James. This is State of the Union on 91.5 WNYE FM. The first 100 days of President Trump came and went. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, it came and went. 100 days of failure, 100 days of chaos, 100 days of confusion, and 100 days of corruption. Days that began with, you know, they completely scrubbed the websites of certain agents, federal agencies. There's no reference to the members, to the LGBT community. Voting Rights Act, they withdrew, Justice Department withdrew from a significant number of cases challenging voter suppression in the South and in other states around this country. The president issued executive orders basically, you know, urging states to defund Planned Parenthood. We are seeing more hate against the Jewish community, against the Muslim community, against the communities of color, against immigrants. What we're seeing is the rollback of an attempt to roll back Obamacare. 20 million Americans will lose their health care budgets that provide tax breaks and tax cuts to the rich, budgets that would disallow any deduction for local and state taxes, proposed budgets that would obviously hurt the sanctuary cities. We also saw an attempt by Betty, not an attempt, she actually did it, Betty DeVos,
right,
to reverse any reform with student loans. But despite all of that, you know, we are winning. We were successful in challenging him in court against the Muslim ban number one, Muslim ban number two, an executive order that would hurt sanctuary cities like New York City. We were successful in defeating that. So we are you know, beating him back. The only, I would guess, huge success that he has was he nominated a Supreme Court justice, but that was only after Congress decided to exercise the nuclear option. We've got to continue to keep our eyes on the prize. He visited New York City recently. There were protests all throughout New York City as he came here to visit the Intrepid, and we made our voices loud and clear that immigrants and refugees are welcome here, but more important, that he's not welcome here. And so I just want to thank everyone for their resistance, but we've got to continue not to grow weary, but to continue to raise our voices and to protect the values and principles that we hold dear, and that is democracy, which is at threat right now.
And finally, let me just shift back to New York City. You have been an advocate for universal free school lunch, and would you say a few words about that as we are in the budget season?
So the proposal is to provide a lunch to all children, regardless of income. And, you know, there has been the stigma associated with free lunch, and we want to remove that stigma so that all children, low-income children, homeless children, children of means, can all sit together at one table and enjoy lunch. It's really about universal free lunch provided to all students, regardless of income, and there should be no separation. And the best way to do that is to have children sit at a table and break bread, get past their differences, get past any misunderstanding, and get to know one another, because these individuals represent our future, and our future looks bright if they can all sit at the same table.
Letitia James is the public advocate of the City of New York, and it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks very much for being with us.
I thank you, Chris, again, for allowing me to be on your radio show.
Yeah, and you will be on the television show as soon as I have one.
Thank you. Thanks so much. And again, it's an honor and a privilege to get the support of DC 37. And thanks. And I want to, again, continue to thank and praise the members of DC 37 who keep our city running each and every day. They are the proud face of New York City.
We'll be right back.
Bye-bye.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
Welcome back. This is State of the Union on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. This is the District Council 37 radio show. And joining us now is Jessica Swenson. She is supervising immigration attorney for Bronx Defenders. Welcome to the program, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking to, in the latest issue of Public Employee Press, which is just out in mailboxes now for members, there is a troubling story about a DC 37 member. Jose Molina is an associate Park Services worker. He has been working for the Parks Department since 2007. He is a family man, 39 years old, with two kids and a wife who is an American citizen. And on a cold January morning in 2013, the agents of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement banged down the door of their Bronx apartment to and wound up taking Jose Molina away for a mistake that he committed 20 years ago. And he is now facing deportation charges. There will be a hearing on June 8th. Jessica, tell us a little bit more about Jose's story.
Sure. Well, like you said, I represent Jose Molina in his removal proceedings. And so he is being charged with being removable for this conviction that occurred, like you said, over 20 years ago. And that is really the state of affairs in immigration law right now. There's no statute of limitations. You can be deported for any offense, no matter how old it is. And so what Jose is up against is something that he did and served the time for and has moved on from, and then some. Like you said, he has two kids, he has a wife, he has a great job. He's now facing deportation to a country that he hasn't been to since he was a year old.
Right. He came to this country as an infant from Panama, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And he doesn't really even know Panama. I mean,
he's never been back.
And as you say, he let's not minimize this. He got into trouble. He served 2.5 years, and then he really did what we expect people who get into trouble do, and what we wish that they would do, which was he turned his life around. And there was no criminal activity afterwards of any shape or form. He has been working for the parks. He's a New York City worker. And yet the tyranny of the law has made this a very difficult situation for him and his family.
Yes, that's true. And another thing worth mentioning is that because of how complicated the immigration law is on every different level, Jose narrowly missed being what's called a derivative citizen, basically automatically becoming a citizen through a parent in two different ways. He narrowly missed driving citizenship through his mom, and he narrowly missed being able to do what's called acquire citizenship through his stepdad, who's actually a U.S. citizen. And it's the only dad that he's ever known since he was a baby. So he, you know, was sort of just because of these arbitrary laws that are set up, he is now facing deportation to Panama, and he hasn't been there since he was an infant.
Listeners who want to read the story in more detail, you can visit the DC 37 website at www.dc37.net, and you can click on there about the story of Jose Molina. Jessica, you are a supervising immigration attorney. I would imagine that this year has been very complicated just in general. I mean, for the subject of immigration and dealing with immigration cases.
Yeah, it's certainly been challenging. It's been fraught. Just to be clear, you know, Jose was picked up by ICE well before Trump took office. These are policies that have been in place, you know, from the Obama administration, before the Obama administration, before the Bush administration. So ICE has been rounding up people and sort of terrorizing our communities since I've been in practice, but well before that. But as you mentioned, since Trump has been in office, it has been a different ballgame. We are seeing an uptick in enforcement and specifically targeting people who weren't targeted under the Obama administration. And it definitely has our phones ringing off the hooks with clients and community members who are afraid to just go out and do their day-to-day activities.
I was at a city council hearing last week, and a number that came up, they were talking about the number of ICE. It was about requests made by ICE to the New York City Police Department.
Right.
And then, but the number that it was like 182 this year, but the policeman who was testifying, I think it was a deputy commissioner, there was a number of 2,000 for 1 year during the Obama administration. And I thought, this is a problem that has been going on for a long time. And that number was astounding. You know, are there things that trigger and that keep these laws so difficult and so onerous and so troubling? I mean, is it about the politics, or is it about how complicated it is to do the right thing by law?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think that it's multi-layered. I think politics certainly comes into play. There is something that's referred to as the bed mandate, and that is a certain number of actual detention beds that are set. It's a number set by Congress, and at all times need to be available and filled by immigration detainees. So regardless of other priorities for who our country decides should be deported, shouldn't be deported, we have this congressional mandate of how many people need to be detained at any given moment. And, you know, you can read into that what you will with which different entities or companies or corporations are benefiting from having a bed mandate, keeping in mind that a lot of our immigration detainees are housed at local jails and with private prison corporations. So that's one issue. Another issue is just, you know, it's sort of the tough on crime rhetoric. It's really, I think, difficult to get things through our legislative bodies that have any carve-outs for people with criminal records, no matter how old they are. And I think that that's a real problem because we see our clients, like Jose in particular, who, yes, he has a criminal record. You know, there's no denying that, but he's still a person. He's still a person with a family, and he deserves not only representation, but to stay in this country. And I think it's been really difficult to make exceptions, especially for people in Jose's situation.
You know,
go ahead.
Thinking about what you were saying, you watch, I hate to have to bring this up, but you watch Fox News, and there'll be people on that network talking about these worst case scenario situations where violent crimes have been committed. And you can just sense the older demographic listener or watcher of Fox News, you know, the fear of foreigners taking over and, you know, and violent criminals among them. That rhetoric is so harmful. And if you live in a real world where people make mistakes, and there are so many of them trying to correct those mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems that, you know, with Trump has come open doors for people's racism and xenophobia to sort of take center stage, whereas they might have been hiding that previously. And people aren't afraid anymore to come out and say what they really think. And you're absolutely right. It's that it's maybe an inability to put yourself in another person's position or believe that they deserve a second chance.
What is happening now? What can be done for Jose now in terms of this process? I mean, what is it that you're trying to do, and how does one go about
right.
doing that? I mean, I just want to... Yeah, go ahead.
So what Jose is really up against is a conviction that under immigration law is termed as an aggravated felony. That's like a legal term of art, so many different types of convictions could fall into that classification. And what the 1996 immigration laws did is basically puffed up this classification of aggravated felony to mean that if you have a conviction that falls under that, you're basically not eligible for any type of relief from deportation. And when I say relief from deportation, I mean there are certain types of things that could make you be subject to being put into deportation proceedings, and then you still might be eligible to ask for a pardon or some other application you could file to stay here despite being subject to deportation. What an aggravated felony means is that you're likely ineligible for all types of discretionary relief from deportation. And that's what Jose is up against. His conviction from 20 years ago, from when he was a kid, he was really a kid at the time,
right.
Has been classified as an aggravated felony. You know, the law is always changing. We're always keeping our eye out for ways to make arguments that convictions are improperly classified. But the most likely way that Jose would be able to get out of this situation is asking for a pardon from Governor Cuomo. And actually, we have a law firm working pro bono on that right now. And we're really trying to rally support around his pardon application.
Okay, as I say, this is the case of Jose Molina, a city worker, a family man with two kids, who faces a hearing on June 8th. And to find out more about this situation, is there a website to find out more about the work that you're doing, or is there some way that people can voice their support for Jose?
Yes, absolutely. So on the Immigrant Defense Project website, there's a video of Jose Molina, and there should be links to support him in particular. And then my organization is the Bronx Defenders, and we actually have been able to take Jose's case through the New York Immigrant Family Unity Project, which up until this point has been a city council funded project. It's universal representation for detained New York City residents in removal proceedings. And right now we're really in a big push to be able to keep our funding and keep our funding to represent everyone despite their level of criminal conviction. So if you're in support of us, then please come to Bronx Defenders website and support our continued funding.
Jessica Swenson, Supervising Immigration Attorney for Bronx Defenders. Again, you can also find out more about this story on www.dc37.net. Thank you very much, Jessica, for being with us on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for voicing Jose's story.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
Bye.
Joining us now to talk about members' concerns with the immigration issues is Robert Martin, who is the Associate Director of the Municipal Employees Legal Services. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, Chris.
So we were just talking with Jessica Swenson. She's the supervising immigration attorney at Bronx Defenders. She is representing Jose Molina, one of our members. And it just, you know, it's clear that that what is the environment that we're now in has, I'm sure, a lot of folks concerned about their rights as immigrants. And I'm wondering what you're seeing, you know, from the MEL's perspective within the union.
Chris, we have seen an uptick since the election, since Donald Trump was elected president, in calls that we're getting from people with really a variety of questions and situations with immigration and citizenship. And there's a common thread that people understandably are nervous.
And what can you do about that?
Well, what MELS does and our coverage for people that are eligible for our services, our working city employees and retirees, is that we provide representation in citizenship cases, people that already have a green card and want to become citizens. And then we will take phone calls and provide referrals in other citizenship matters. We will try to get people, if we can't provide full representation, we try to talk to people and get them headed in the right direction.
And in terms of the numbers, are you getting a lot more calls, is what you're saying, or you're getting a lot more inquiries than you had been?
It's a pretty significant number. I don't have an exact percentage or number. We noticed it immediately the day after the election that we were getting more calls. People are worrying, will I be deported? Will a family member be deported or be in a situation that's unclear, where they're in danger of being picked up? And then we also get calls from people who've had a green card maybe for many years and want to know how they can become a citizen. And that's something which we encourage people to go ahead and apply for citizenship if they have a green card. But it should be done carefully, because there are things that there can be roadblocks in the way, even if you have a green card, if you want to become a citizen.
Robert Martin is the Associate Director of the Municipal Employees Legal Services. For information about MELS, please call 212-815-1111. Yeah, 212-815-1111. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, sir.
All right. That's just about all the time we have for this week's program. I want to thank my guests, Public Advocate Letitia James, Jessica Swenson from the Bronx Defenders, and Robert Martin of DC 37's MELS program. If anything you heard on this show, drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. The engineer is Andrea Monocchio. Rudy Orozco is the producer. Until next time, ciao.